recognize cuirassier, and of his own wounds he'd gathered on the journey. He bit his tongue, hard, clamping down on his rage, and considered having Taniel Two-Shot come after him if he staved Carpole's head in this very instant.
"How long have you known?"
he managed when he finally allowed himself to speak.
"I have suspected for a few days."
"And you didn't tell me this back at the Cuirassiers' camp, or any time since, as we rode deeper into enemy territory?"
Carpole's anger and defiance finally flagged, her gaze falling.
"I needed to be sure."
"So, what?"
Stike raised his hands, then let them fall at his sides again. He paced in the surf.
"Your internal compass, this thing that's been leading as many as 2,000 men across a continent of war, is off? By what? 1,000 miles?
"More like 500, I think."
Stike scoffed. 500 miles?
He pointed to the ocean, finally taking that half-step forward.
"I can't ride my lances across an ocean. Unless you're hiding something beyond that blood magic, I don't think you can do anything to change that. Can you?"
He paused, feeling suddenly lost. All this time, all these lives, for nothing.
"Can you?"
he whispered. Carpole shook her head. Stike climbed back up the cliffs, leaving Jackal to keep an eye on Celine. By the time he reached the top, his mind was made up, his resolve strengthened. He found Ibana and Gustav waiting for him, while the Lancers prepared a camp just beneath the rise of the hill, where they couldn't be spotted by passing ships.
"Pack it up," he said quietly.
Ibana's eyebrows rose.
"Excuse me?"
"We're going back. The Blood Sorcerer was wrong. The Godstone lies beyond the ocean."
Both Ibana and Gustav stared at him, working their jaws, coming to terms with this news.
"Beyond the ocean?"
Gustav asked, rubbing a hand across the stubble on his cheek.
"That's what I said, isn't it?"
Stike couldn't feel anything but anger right now, and he fought the urge to go find Amrek, take Celine, and ride off before anyone could stop him. He wondered if he should just do that, if this dream of a reborn Mad Lancers was just a fool's errand. He shouldered Gustav out the way, heading toward Amrek. He heard boots behind him and Ibana say in a warning tone,
"Don't meddle with him in this mood."
Gustav snatched him by the arm a moment later. Stike whirled, his boss knife coming to hand, and snatched Gustav up by the front of his jacket.
"Pack!"
Stike ordered.
"Ben!"
Ibana warned. Stike looked at Ibana, then lowered his eyes to Gustav. The rifle jack met the gaze. He could see resolve there, and questions, and a hint of fear. But Gustav did not shake or shy away. Stike set him down and shoved him, putting up his knife. He took several steps before the hopelessness seized him. It began in his chest like a spike of cold iron and quickly overwhelmed him, until his steps became staggered and he was forced to sit on the closest rock, his head falling into his hands.
"Pack everything back up," Stike said again. "Leave the Boni. She can find her own way back."
Ibana joined Gustav, and the two of them stared down at Stike. He could feel their eyes on his shoulders.
"Back? Where?"
Ibana asked. Stike gave a half shrug, unwilling to raise his head. He'd seen plenty of men have a breakdown on the field of battle. He'd never experienced one himself, and the very idea of him sitting here fighting back tears, immobilized by hopelessness, almost made him laugh. He was Mad Ben Stike, and a 90-pound woman leading his army astray had cut him off at the knees. He wished Ibana and Gustav would go away.
"Back to landfall,"
he answered. He gestured at Gustav without looking up.
"We'll deliver you and yours back to Lady Flint. It's the least I can do."
"And then?"
Gustav asked.
"And then we'll do what we do best. We'll slaughter our way back and forth across Fatrasta until either the invaders are dead or we are."
There was a measured silence.
"That sounds directionless,"
Gustav said gently.
"It worked for us before,"
Stike said. Ibana sighed, pacing back and forth. Stike knew she'd have words for him later when they were out of earshot of the men. He wasn't looking forward to it.
"Well, sir."
Something changed in Gustav's voice, and Stike glanced up to find him standing at attention.
"It's been a pleasure serving under you. I appreciate the offer, but the Riflejack Cavalry will take our leave. Good day, sir."
Gustav snapped a salute and spun on his heel, heading toward his men. Stike exchanged a glance with Ibana.
"What a pit is he going on about? Gustav! Come back here!"
Gustav froze. Hesitantly, he returned to Stike, giving him a shallow smile and straightening his jacket where Stike had clutched it.
"Yes, sir."
Stike put his elbows on his knees, looking up at Gustav, fighting against his despair and shushing the little voice that told him to let Gustav walk away.
"Where are you going?"
"To fulfill our duty, sir."
"What duty?"
"To escort Karpol to the Godstancer. I was given very specific instructions by Lady Flint, and I intend on carrying them out."
Stike shook his head in wonderment.
"Did you not hear me? The Godstone is in Thionise. She can't lead us to it."
"We've come this far," Gustav said, brushing off Stike's words. "A little bit of ocean between us and our goal will hardly stop the Riflejacks. There aren't as many of us left as I'd like. 500, give or take a few dozen. That'll make it easier to find enough ships to commandeer to get to Dionysus."
Stike pointed to the ocean with his knife.
"You're gonna commandeer a fleet and head to Dionysus? Pitt knows what's waiting for you there. Not knowing what's over the next hill doesn't seem like something that would bother you, sir,"
Gustav said, managing to pull it off without the slightest condescension. Stike stared at him, wondering if maybe he had finally been taken by the madness so many had accused him of over the years. Gustav went on.
"I've got orders, sir. Unless you have any other questions, I'd best go let the lads know that we're splitting off."
Stike waved him off, his feeling of hopelessness fouled by exasperation. He shook his head, and Gustav had gone about a dozen feet before Stike said,
"Why?"
"Because I have orders, sir,"
Gustav said without turning.
"Bugger orders. You Adran pricks don't follow orders to certain death. Lady Flint isn't worth that. Nobody is."
Gustav stiffened. Slowly, steadily, he returned to Stike and squatted down in front of him, like a man about to explain something to a little child. He said,
"Field Marshal Tamas was worth it. Lady Flint, Flora, as most of us knew her when she was still a girl, she might not be quite there yet, but she will be some day, of that I'm certain."
Gustav paused as if choosing his words.
"Stike, we haven't ridden across Fatrasta for you, or a blood sorcerer, or even for Lady Flint. We rode across Fatrasta because a god killed Field Marshal Tamas and tried to destroy our country. You may keep the truth of what we're actually doing here from yours, but I don't from mine. We faced the father god of them all on the battlefield, and we were nothing but rain in his eyes. Every one of us remembers that, and if we have to throw away our lives on the chance of preventing another piece of shit godling from walking this world, we will do so. Not for you, or your damned country, or to help you spread the carnage of your vengeance across the continent. We'll do it to protect our homes and loved ones. Lady Flint understood that. It's why she sent us out.
Gustav left Stike, returning to his cavalry. Stike watched him go with a frustrated sigh. His eyes went to Urbana, who just shrugged and followed Gustav without a word. Stike stared at the ground, letting the tip of his knife fall to the dirt and slowly scratching it back and forth to create parallel lines. He knew he should be doing something, but he didn't know what. Urbana would inform the men. Gustav would leave. The Mad Lancers would carry on. He tried to tell himself that the Godstone had been a long shot anyway, that even if they'd found it, there was no guarantee Karpol could dampen its power. That this whole mistake, this misled party teetering on the edge of the continent, was Karpol's fault. So why did he feel so strongly like a failure? He felt a small hand on his arm. Celine took him by the wrist, forcing him to sit up, then moved his arm to one side so she could sit on his knee. He had a hard time meeting her gaze.
"Karpol is sorry," Celine said.
Stike didn't answer her.
"I don't think..."
Celine trailed off, then took a deep breath.
"I don't think she is certain of herself. She acts confident, but I think she scares herself."
"In what way?" Stike asked petulantly.
"Her strength. That thing she did to the cuirassiers in the forest."
Stike looked up sharply, cutting her off.
"How did you know about that?"
"She told me. She told me that she has controlled men before, even hundreds at a time, but that she's never enthralled them like that. She needed answers and took control of them, and she told me that it scared her."
"Why would she tell you this?" Stike asked,
trying to decide if this was some sort of manipulation. Celine didn't even have to consider the question. She frowned at Stike as if the answer was obvious.
"Because she's lonely. I'm the only one she has to talk to. The soldiers are frightened of her, and you treat her like a tool. Her love is on the other side of the continent, fighting for his life, and she wants to be at his side, where she can protect him."
Stike thought of their meeting outside of Landfall, when he had accepted the commission in the Riflejacks and had sent out the order to gather the Mad Lancers. He had waited in that small town, wondering if his old comrades would come when he called, and she had appeared. She had smeared his forehead with blood, and then vanished on the wind. He touched his forehead. Celine didn't miss the gesture.
"She marked you."
"With a sorcery?"
"In a way. She says she will not try to control you, that she is not sure if she can."
"And why does she mark me?"
"As her protector, like Taniel."
"Why me?"
"Because you're one of the good ones."
Stike almost laughed. He shook his head, looking at Celine's earnest face.
"I'm not one of the good ones, my girl. You've seen it with your own eyes. I'm no one's protector."
"But you protect Fatrasta."
"Well, that's different. It's a continent, an idea, not a person."
He trailed off.
"I'm not going to argue semantics with you."
Celine took his hand in hers.
"You protect me. Back in the camps, and since. Sunin says that you would break a mountain over your shoulders to protect me, and I believe her."
Stike's eyes were suddenly misty. He dragged his sleeves across his face.
"I would."
"So? Karpol is alone. You are all that stands between her and the Dionys. She may be powerful, but she's fragile, too. Halt the sea. Break a mountain. Be her protector, too.
Celine leaned forward and kissed Stike on the cheek, then slid out of his lap and pulled on his hand in the direction of the camp. Stike stared at the blade of his knife.
We should ride off. Tonight, when everyone is asleep. I can take you to the Nine and build us a house in the mountains and let you be a kid for a few years. This isn't the place for you.
I know, Celine said seriously. We can do that when this is over. I want you to teach me all about the horses.
Shit, Stike said, climbing to his feet.
The hopelessness still weighed him down, clutching at his muscles like a punch to the gut. He walked hand in hand with Celine, gesturing to Ibana to follow, and heading toward where the riflejacks were in the middle of repacking their gear. Carpole stood next to Gustav, holding her slate and a bit of chalk. The two glanced up at Stike as he approached. Stike pointed at Carpole.
I'm still pissed at you, but I made a promise, and I'll damn well keep it. Gustav, the only place we're going to find enough ships to get to Dionysus is New Starlight. Tell your men to set up camp. We'll need a lot of rest if we're to assault the fortress.
Chapter 58
It's almost ready.
Flora didn't acknowledge Flaring, not immediately. She was watching the preparations around the Godstone from a safe distance, the other side of Nighttime Vale. She resisted the urge to reply, It took you long enough. 3 days had passed since the Riflejacks had arrived, and Bert had given her his blessing. 3 of the 4 days that it would take 25,000 Dionysus infantry to catch up with them. They had gone well past their threshold of make a clean escape, and had fallen to hope the Dionysus are sufficiently confused by the destruction of the Godstone that we can slip away in the chaos. Flora finally turned her eyes to Flaring to find her vigorously scratching one arm.
A thing makes my skin itch, Flaring explained.
Right. That's why I've kept my distance. Is this going to work?
No reason it won't, Flaring replied.
We packed its brother with enough powder to level a city without causing a scratch.
Flaring snorted.
See, there's your problem. You just cover it in black powder and light the damn thing. Most of the explosive force will be lost going in every direction except toward the item itself. That's like trying to knock down a wall by throwing the artillery piece at it.
She smiled across the valley toward the Godstone, an expression that Flora imagined had been on her face on more than one occasion while sizing up an enemy general.
No, we used every ounce of blasting oil we had left. We turned it into a gel and applied it to the nooks and crannies. We've timed 7 different explosions to occur in split-second intervals. This is top science, Flora. God sorcery can eat my shit.
I would rather not invite that kind of hubris, Flora replied. Her soldiers were literally lined up outside of town, waiting for the order to head north double time if the Godstone was destroyed. If the blasting oil had no effect, her second plan was also ready to be put into motion. All of her engineers standing by with the necessary equipment to lift the Godstone onto a series of heavy-duty carts to drag it out of town. And if that didn't work, Prime Lecter would bring the mountain down on top of the Godstone and then stick around to hide it from the approaching Dionysus army. She had planned for everything, she hoped, and in a few minutes she would know what needed to happen next. A fear in the back of her head told her that something would go wrong, that the Dionysus, whom Olam's scouts had already spotted, would arrive 12 hours ahead of schedule, or that the blasting oil would cause some sort of sorcerer's backlash that would kill them all, or that they'd be forced to run with the Godstone, and the Dionysus would be upon them within days, slaughtering her outnumbered men.
I don't believe in hubris,
Fleming said, breaking the silence. Flora turned and looked at her, staring just long enough for Fleming to become visibly uncomfortable.
"Please, never say that again."
Her attention was pulled away by the sight of a group coming up from Yellow Creek. She didn't have to sniff powder to pick out the people in attendance. Taniel, Olam, Bert, Prime Lector, and Juline, accompanied by several of Flering's assistants. They joined Flora and Fleming within a few minutes, and it quickly became clear that they'd been arguing for some time.
"It won't work," Prime Lector said with a huff. "The powder of the combined Predii couldn't crack one of those things 2,000 years ago. Some damned gelled explosive won't do it either."
Juline stood beside him, looking sullen and uninterested. She waved one of her bronze hands under Prime's nose.
"Four of you together couldn't kill me, either. Then along came Kresimir and cut off my hands without breaking a sweat."
"That's different," Prime insisted. "That's powerful sorcery. The same kind of sorcery that's involved here. It only proves my point."
"And you've missed hers entirely," Taniel said quietly, rolling his eyes, "which is that nothing can be taken for granted."
Prime turned on Taniel, sizing him up for a moment in undignified silence. If anything, Taniel himself was living proof of that very statement. Flora could see Prime swallow a pithy reply, and took more than a little amusement by the fact that Taniel could keep someone like Prime in check.
"You think this is going to work?"
"I have no idea," Taniel replied. "I can certainly hope."
"Hope is worth nothing. We must plan."
"We've planned,"
Flora finally cut in, "as much as we possibly can. All we need is for you to do your part if the moment calls for it. Can we trust you to do so?"
Prime drew himself up.
"I will do my part."
"The same way you stood up to Kresimir after he returned?"
Juline scoffed. Bert circled around the group and came up to Flora's side, giving the others a skeptical look.
"You're sure these are ancient sorcerers?"
he asked quietly.
"I'm sure,"
Flora replied.
"They've been complaining and squabbling like children since the moment I met them."
"They're just like that,"
Taniel said, turning his back on Prime and Juline.
"The more you get to know the most powerful people in the world, the more you realize they're just that. Powerful people. If it makes you feel any better, Kresimir was worse than either of them."
"No," Bert said. "That does not make me feel better."
Fleming continued to scratch her arms, looking more and more perplexed.
"It's going to work,"
she repeated, with somewhat less confidence than before. She stared at Prime and Juline while she talked, clearly more uncomfortable with their presence than with even the obelisk she planned on destroying.
"We're going to turn that thing to dust. Then we're going to hightail it out of this city before the Dionys can catch up."
Flora put a hand on Flaring's shoulder.
"Just tell us when to watch."
"Just a few more minutes, it looks like,"
Flaring said.
"My boys are triple-checking the detonators, and we'll be ready to go."
Flora couldn't help the thumping of her heart, and hoped that her anxiety didn't show on her face. What if Prime was right? What if it proved impossible to move the stone, and then he fled instead of hiding the stone from the Dionys? If the stone fell into Dionys' hands, they would have possession of 2 of the 3. She didn't know exactly how bad that would be, but there was a dark fear in the pit of her stomach that told her it would be catastrophic. Her thoughts were interrupted by Flaring suddenly growing very still, staring across the valley, then waving back at someone.
"We're ready,"
she announced. Prime and Julien immediately ceased their bickering, and the group fell out into a line, watching curiously until Flering motioned to them.
You should probably all get behind those rocks, she told them.
We're awfully far away, Taniel said doubtfully. Bert was already following Flering towards some boulders, and Vlora and Olam were right behind her.
Trust me, Vlora told him. If Flering says to duck, then we duck.
Within a few moments, they were all situated under the cover of a pair of boulders, peeking out cautiously toward the Godstone. Vlora turned her attention toward two of Flering's assistants, who were still within throwing distance of the stone. They were, she realized, following a long cord down to the outlet of the valley, before taking refuge clear around the other side of the rock faces that guarded the entrance to the vale. Vlora took a small hit of powder, watching carefully for a few tense moments before a bright flash suddenly flared from the assistant's hiding spot. The flash whipped along the ground with astonishing speed, following the cord up toward the Godstone. It sped across the valley, then up the path. The explosions were nothing like the eruption of gunpowder. Instead of a boom followed by inky smoke, there was an ear-shattering crack. As Flering had warned, there were 7 distinct explosions. They happened so closely to one another that even Vlora's sorcery-enhanced senses could barely tell them apart. Dust was sent in every direction, allowing Vlora to follow the force of the explosion across the valley as rocks scattered and leaves were blown off trees. She grabbed Olam and pulled him down with her, hiding behind the boulder, while the entire side of the valley was peppered with stones thrown over 1/2 mile away. A rock the size of a head struck just a few yards behind them, smoking from the blast.
"Holy shit," Bert said.
Laura lifted her head to peer through the haze, trying to see what had happened to the Godstone. As the air began to clear, she felt her heart fall.
"Nothing happened," she said.
Beside her, Taniel was also squinting toward the Godstone. He shook his head and suddenly lifted himself up and over the boulder, taking off at a run. Vlora was about to let him go when she saw what he must have seen. Something had happened. Without a word to the others, she took off after him. The whole group was gathered around the stone within 10 minutes. Vlora walked around and around it, unable to stop grinning like an idiot. The obelisk had been shattered into 3 distinct pieces. The smallest was the cap, a pyramid-shaped stone around 4 feet in diameter. The rest of the stone had broken in half, lengthwise, and the pieces now rested with about a 2-inch gap between them. Flering slapped her hand victoriously on the capstone.
"Ancient sorcery, meet modern science!"
Prime Lecter stood back about 20 paces, staring at the Godstone with a mix of fascination and horror, as if expecting the stone to reassemble itself at any moment. He seemed at a loss for words until Flering spoke, to which he replied,
"It's not exactly dust." "It cracked along the seams," Flering said, tracing her fingers along the break between the 2 halves of the main obelisk. "Just as planned. There were 2 deep grooves cut along fault lines in the rock, and we focused most of the explosion there."
She tapped a section of the capstone, where a large area of writing had been replaced by a spiraling fracture, much like glass in a window that had been shattered without falling from the pane.
"Yeah, it's true. All that ore should have turned this thing to dust. But considering how you were talking about that sorcery, I think we did pretty good."
Slowly, Vlora felt her smile fade. She took a step toward the stone and gently laid a hand on the surface. She felt a pulse, like the beating of a heart, touching her from the else. It was an unpleasant feeling, and she immediately wanted to wipe her hand off and leave this place at once. She forced calm. I can still sense the sorcery of the thing.
So can I, Prime Lecter said.
Taniel and Juleen both confirmed it.
It's faded, Taniel said to Flering's annoyed expression. But it's definitely still there. Do you think whoever built this thing planned for the possibility of it being broken?
Flora expected Prime to look smug, but the old sorcerer seemed baffled more than anything else.
It's possible, he said. But they made it so strong that they must have thought it would survive anything. I doubt a god could crack it.
Not even Kresimir could have conceived of a man-made force as strong as blasting oil, Juleen said with a hint of wonder in her voice.
She tapped her right stub against the capstone, examining it with a clinical approach.
Normally, when an object has been enchanted, substantial damage to it will unravel the enchantment. It may be that...
She trailed off.
Ah, I see.
What is it? Flora demanded. Her anxiety was back, and she'd gone from disappointment to elation and back again so quickly in the last quarter of an hour that she just wanted to know what the pit was going on. Juleen turned and smiled smugly at Prime.
"Do you see it?"
she asked. With some reservation, Prime shook his head.
"Those fault lines in the stone are also fault lines in the sorcery. We couldn't see it, not when it was full strength. They must have bound the sorcery to the very grain of the rock. Helps make it stronger, but it also makes it vulnerable. The sorcery holding the whole thing together is like an outer layer. We broke through that with the blasting oil, leaving three distinct pieces of enchanted rock.
So, instead of having to deal with one godstone, we're dealing with three?
Bert asked flatly.
Not exactly, Juleen continued.
She perked up from her usual disinterest and had even grown excited.
It's not a godstone now. Not nearly. The pieces are nothing compared to the whole. I think that it could be put back together given time, but...
If we can separate the pieces, Laura finished for her. Her mind was already working, pushing through a number of different plans.
Which is the most powerful piece?
I see it now. Prime finally announced. Power is the wrong way of thinking about it. The two halves of the main trunk are where the meat of the sorcery is, but the capstone, though weaker, is used to connect them, to make the three of them greater than the sum of their parts.
That's all I need to know.
Flora turned to Bert, her heart racing. The moment she'd been waiting for, where she could see the next path she needed to take, was finally here.
You told us that you had made plans to take the stone north of the Iron Hook Mountains if you could find it. Can you still do that?
The question seemed to catch everyone off guard, including Bert. Taniel stepped forward before Bert could respond.
Are you sure about this?
He asked quietly. Flora ignored him. Can you? She asked again. Bert eyeballed the pieces.
What do you need me to do?
I want you to take the two pieces of the main trunk and take them over the passes. As soon as you're north of the mountains, separate the two pieces. Send them to the farthest reaches of your territory or beyond. I don't really care who ends up with them, as long as they are in two very different places.
This is madness, Prime interjected. We can't trust northern savages with even a fragment of the stone, let alone two-thirds.
Bert narrowed his eyes at the word savages.
Then come with us, old man. You want to study them so badly, then we'll take you north with the pieces, and you can make sure they're disposed of or hidden.
It was Flora's turn to be surprised.
I thought you don't allow Cressians north of the Iron Hook.
Like I told you before, the Dianais have changed everything, and we need to make decisions quickly. Besides, I have a feeling I know what your plan is, and I want insurance.
What do you mean by insurance? Taniel asked.
Bert pointed at Prime. This one can hide the presence of the Godstones. If he continues to do that, it'll give my people plenty of time to pull the two big pieces into the passes and dynamite them behind us. We'll be long gone before the Dianai's privilege can figure out something is up.
Olam, who had remained silent for this entire time, suddenly spoke up, fixing Flora with a pained expression.
We're gonna take the capstone, aren't we?
And lead the Dianais on a merry chase, Flora confirmed, locking eyes with Taniel. We take the capstone to the coast, put it on a ship, and we drop it into the deepest part of the ocean. And even if the Dianais happen to catch up with us, they'll wind up with just a fraction of what they need, and no idea where the rest has been taken.
Olam considered the idea for a moment, and Flora could see in his eyes that he thought it was going to get them all killed. He stared at the Godstone, looking older than Flora remembered him, and drawing out a pang of worry from her.
All right, he said. But the Dianais are almost upon us. I'll have our engineers up here in half an hour, and we'll be rumbling out of the town in two. We need to get as far away as we can before nightfall.
Chapter 59 Stike crested a hill and tugged gently on his reins, bringing Amrek and the entire column behind them to a stop in the middle of the road. He eyed the distant towers of New Starlight for a few moments, then swept his gaze across the rolling hills between his own party and the city fortress, before bringing his looking-glass to his eye to get a better look.
"That's a lot more crowded than when we passed here 5 days ago," Ivana commented.
She sat beside Stike, her comments no doubt directed at the army, now camped at the base of the curtain wall, that cut New Starlight off from the mainland. At a glance, and without a glass, any seasoned campaigner would put the army at 50,000 men or more.
"That's going to be a problem," Ivana added. "We can't break an entire field army, not by ourselves."
Stike kept the glass to his eyes, frowning toward the city, and sweeping his gaze back and forth across the army camping outside it, to make sure that his head wasn't playing tricks on him.
"We may not have to."
He handed Ibana the looking-glass and sat back in the saddle, fiddling with his big lancer's ring. Slowly, Ibana's mouth fell open.
"Those are for trusting flags."
"Above the army and the city," Stike confirmed.
"I'm not mad, am I?"
"Not about this."
Ivana handed the looking-glass back.
"It's been 5 days since we passed here, and we very clearly saw Dianai soldiers manning the wall. Where did that army come from, and how the pit did they take New Starlight without a siege?"
Stike took off his ring, spat upon it, and polished it against his jacket before returning it to his finger.
"I think that's Devori and the Third."
"I knew we hadn't seen the last of him," Ivana grunted.
"Is this going to make our job easier or harder?"
Stike asked, though he thought he already knew the answer.
"Harder," Ivana said.
She swore, then continued, "If there's a fleet at harbour, Devori isn't going to give it to us. But..." She trailed off.
"But," Stike picked up, "I'd damn well like to know how he got here so fast. And how he took New Starlight."
"Right.
Do you want me to send Jackal?"
Stike felt uneasy. He felt that way a lot these days, dealing with Carpole and renegade cuirassiers and assassin dragon men. But this felt different to him, and he couldn't figure out why. The army was flying the flags of the Third. It was a whole field army, with Devori at the head.
He ignored Ibana's question and asked his own.
Do you think he sold himself to the Dainais?
Divori?
Yeah.
He's a slimy piece of shit, but there's no way he turned an entire field down, eh? I know dozens of good, loyal soldiers in the Third. Stike chewed on the inside of his cheek.
Hear me, Jackal. We're going to take a closer look.
Stike and Jackal approached the pickets of the army camped outside of New Starlight and were waved through with only a lingering glance and a curious whisper. They were soon among the tents, riding down the main road that led to the curtain wall and the city fortress beyond it. Stike kept his eyes and ears open, keeping Amrek at a walk, trying to shake the uneasiness that plagued his thoughts. The army was camped at leisure, sprawled and disorganized like an army resting in the spoils of a great victory, though it was clear that there had been no battle to take the city. Soldiers played cards by the cook fires, set up ball fields out by the pickets, and stripped the area of firewood and edibles.
"Are the spirits telling you anything about this?" Stike asked Jackal out of the corner of his mouth.
Jackal looked just as suspicious as Stike, if not more so, and he answered without taking his eyes off the camp.
"The spirits are fickle right now. Most of them have fled from Karpol's sorcery, and the ones who haven't speak in riddles. They're not helpful."
"What do you make of this?"
"I don't like it."
Jackal seemed to have nothing else to add, so Stike let him be. Truth be told, he couldn't add any more himself. The circumstances of the Third Army's arrival seemed suspicious at best, sinister at worst. Yet there was nothing about the camp that spoke to him of sedition or treachery. As they neared the curtain wall, he saw a small group of men gathered playing dice on a plank. One of them glanced up, did a double take, then sprang to his feet and jogged towards Stike. He was a thin, dark-skinned Deliv. He looked like he was in his 40s, with a touch of grey at his temples and a distinctive scar along his left cheek.
"A Colonel Ben Stike?" he asked, falling in beside Amrek.
"That's me."
"A Colonel Willen,"
the man introduced himself.
"I saw you at a distance back near Beltar, but I never got the chance to meet you. I'm with the 74th Rifles. It's a pleasure to meet you, Stike."
Stike pulled on the reins and turned to look down at Willen.
"Pleasure is mine," he said slowly.
The name sounded vaguely familiar, but he couldn't place the face.
"Mind telling me what's going on here?"
"What do you mean?"
Willen seemed genuinely perplexed by the question.
"I mean that 5 days ago I rode past New Starlight and saw Dainai's flags. I come back this way, and the city is held by our side, without any sign of a struggle."
"Ah!"
Willen's grin widened.
Well, sir, oddest bit of luck. I'll tell you, we weren't all that far behind. We arrived just yesterday morning to find the citadel completely abandoned. No ships in the harbour, no spies hiding in the walls. Just an empty husk of a place, stripped of supplies."
Stike leaned on his saddle horn.
"You're joking."
"No ships?"
"That would make it damned hard to get to Dainai's."
"Not at all. I'll tell you, it's the damnedest thing. We had orders to take the city as quickly as possible, but it was empty."
"Do you know why?"
"I'm not one to question fortune, but..."
Willen searched his jacket, produced a tin of tobacco, and tucked a wad into the corner of his mouth before continuing.
"We came across half a brigade of Dainai's cavalry, slaughtered in the hawk. I'm guessing now that it was your doing, and our best guess is that the Dainai's holding the city were spooked and decided to flee."
Stike bit his tongue, holding back a dozen reasons why the Dainai's wouldn't have fled just because of some dead cuirassiers. He looked up at the nearby curtain wall and the high towers of new starlight beyond it, then glanced to the eastern horizon.
"Perhaps," he said. "Perhaps not. Maybe they got wind of a field army on the way and decided they couldn't hold a fortress against it."
It seemed like the only probable reason for abandoning New Starlight. Perhaps Stike was just being paranoid.
"Tell me, did the Dionys spike the fortress guns when they left?"
I'm not sure," Willen replied. "I can ask."
"Do so. Where's Devori?"
"Ah, the general is in the Citadel. His personal company is holding it."
"Taking the choice beds for himself, I suppose."
"A general's prerogative," Willen said demurely. "If you'd like, I'll take you to him."
"No need,
Stike hesitated, exchanging a glance with Jackal.
"Actually, that would be wonderful.
Hold on, I'll fetch my horse." Within a few minutes, Colonel Willen was riding beside them as they headed toward the fortress. They passed beneath the curtain wall, which was staffed with guards from one of the brigades, but not policed. The city fortress within had been taken over by the army. "All the buildings were empty when we arrived," Colonel Willen explained. "As far as we've been able to piece together, the city was abandoned by the garrison the very day that word came that landfall had been taken. The people fled soon after, leaving it abandoned to be picked up by the Dionys."
"That's a shame," Stike said,
watching a company of soldiers march past in the street. Willen spat out a wad of tobacco. "Agreed. A new Starlight isn't protected by sorcery, but the walls are strong and the guns powerful. They could have made a damn good stand against any sized fleet in the area. Pity, I say, but that's what we're here to remedy."
"What exactly are your orders?" Stike glanced sharply at Willen.
"They were secret until we actually arrived," Willen said. "But we were to march across the Hammer and take New Starlight as quickly as possible. Now I believe we'll garrison the city and use it as a staging point to cleanse the Hammer." Willen nodded toward the Citadel. "General Devori is meeting with all the brigadiers and about half the colonels right now. I imagine we'll have our next set of orders by tomorrow." Stike debated his next options. If there were no ships here, then the Citadel was useless to the Mad Lancers. His best bet might be to ride back to Belltower and use the good graces he'd earned with the city to commandeer a small fleet. In which case, he should turn around right now and ride back to camp. He didn't need Devori getting overly curious about his goals.
"Why the urgency?"
he asked Willen.
"Hm? You were told to march across the Hammer and take Starlight as quickly as possible. Why? Did you even bring enough artillery to take the Citadel?"
Only just. About the artillery, that is. We have a battery of 12-pounders and 6 batteries of 6-pounders. As far as the speed..." Willen shrugged. "The orders came directly from Lindet herself."
"One does not question Lindet's orders."
They reached the main door of the Citadel, only to find it closed. Stike rode Amrek right up to the door and gave it a shove. It was locked. He craned his neck, looking up to the murder holes for some sign of a guard detail.
"I say there," Willen called, cupping his hands around his mouth. I say there. Colonel Willen to see General Devori. Open the doors."
They were greeted by silence. Jackal rode back 50 yards, looking toward the top of the walls.
"I don't see anyone," he shouted.
Willen scowled at the door, as if he might open it by annoyance alone.
"Everyone must be at the general's meeting."
"Strange,"
Stike muttered, feeling his uneasiness deepen. They waited for a sign of life from within the Citadel for nearly 15 minutes, until Willen finally shook his head.
I'll send men around to the other gates to find a way in, he assured him. Dvorah's damn bodyguard are too good to open the door, and they'll hear it from me. Can I escort you back to your men?
We're camped down the coast, Stike said. To the east. I can find my own way back.
Of course.
Stike raised one finger, turning Amric this way and that as he examined the city fortress.
How many scouts do you have out right now?
You'd have to ask a dragoon company.
Do you have any dragoons attached to your brigade?
We do. My sister is their commanding officer.
And do me a favour. Get them out into the countryside. The Dainais might have sailed away, but they might also be lurking out there somewhere.
Willan sucked on his teeth, obviously reluctant.
General Dvorah gave the men an informal leave while we wait for our new orders. My sister won't be eager to send her boys out too early.
He paused, looking up at the citadel.
I'll convince her, he added.
Good.
Stike nodded goodbye and turned Amric back toward the mainland. They were out of earshot when Jackal said in a low voice,
You told him we were camped to the east. You don't trust him? I don't want Dvorah to know where we are, Stike replied.
Ibana met them about a mile outside the curtain wall.
I was just about to come looking for you. Is everything all right?
I'm not sure, Stike said with a shake of his head. I want you and Gustav to send out our best scouts, scour the area.
What are we looking for?
Dainais.
A lot? A few?
Stike glanced back toward the citadel one more time. He thought he spotted someone in a yellow jacket on the walls of the citadel, but by the time he found his looking glass, the person had disappeared.
I don't know. Look for anything suspicious.
No fires tonight. Tell the men to be ready to fight or flee at a moment's notice.
Chapter 60 Laura sat on horseback, watching as rows of riflejacks marched past her along the winding, treacherous foothills of the Iron Hook Mountains. Less than 50 hours had passed since Flaring had cracked the Godstone, and even with a swift departure from Yellow Creek, they were only 30 miles or so east of the town. Supply wagons and the big ox cart carrying the capstone slowed them down, as did the rough terrain itself. Their only saving grace was that the men themselves were relatively fresh from days loitering outside of Yellow Creek. But an army could only move as quickly as its slowest piece, and in this case it was the capstone. 16 extra oxen and a whole company of soldiers and engineers stood by to push or pull the wagon through mud or up steep embankments, to repair broken wheels or switch out tired animals. They worked with efficiency found nowhere else in the world, and yet it still wasn't enough.
"Where's Colonel Olam?"
Flora asked one of her aides, eyeing a particularly steep part of the road up ahead. The capstone would be along soon, and the engineers would have to deal with that hill, slowing down the whole army even further.
"I think he's coming up just behind us, ma'am,"
the aide answered. Flora acknowledged her response with a nod and headed back down the column, where she found Olam conferring with several of their engineers, walking beside them as he led his horse. She caught his eye and he broke away, mounting up and coming over to join her.
"We just had word from our scouts," he reported before she could speak. "The Dainais are coming up on us quickly. There's a full brigade just a couple of hours behind us."
Flora swore. How the pit did they catch up so quickly?
Didn't they at least head to Yellow Creek?
They didn't.
Olam unfolded a hand-drawn map of the region and held it where Flora could see.
"As far as we can tell, they changed directions at this road here, heading to cut us off. Either they had better scouts than we expected, or they're privileged were able to sense the capstone moving east, and they made some quick assumptions.
Flora tried to look on the bright side. They've taken the bait.
That they have. By the time they catch us, Bert will have the rest of the Godstone up in the Iron Hook passes. No chance of the Dionys following them up there.
It was, Flora had to admit, a terribly satisfying thing to know that she'd outmaneuvered Carcediel once more. It took an enormous amount of anxiety off her chest. However, she didn't need to remind herself that the Dionys could still slaughter her and all of her men. Saving the world from a Dionys god had been her first priority. Now she needed to get her people back to Adro in one piece, and Olam had not said, "if they catch us," but rather implied, "when."
"Do we have any chance of outrunning them?" she asked quietly.
Olam looked toward the engineers, his expression souring.
"I think we can stay ahead of them if we keep moving. It's just that..."
"Don't lie to me," Laura told him. Olam glanced away, grimacing. "Dragging this capstone with us, we have no chance of staying ahead of the Dionys. As long as we're in the foothills, we can block the roads and keep them from flanking us. But as soon as we break out onto the plains, we'll be surrounded by 5 brigades of infantry." Flora tried to keep from spiralling into a well of despair.
"I've gotten us all killed, haven't I?"
"I'm sure you'll think of something," Olam said confidently.
"That kind of pressure isn't exactly helpful."
"Hasn't stopped you before."
She wanted to slap that reassuring grin off his face.
"If we live through this, my love, please make me retire."
"I'll do my best."
Flora turned to watch as the cart with the capstone was maneuvered up the steep hill on the road ahead of them, and was pleasantly surprised when none of the ropes snapped or the oxen stumbled. It was up and over the hill in just a few minutes, leaving her in a slightly more optimistic mood. She wondered what Tamas would have done in this situation, and realized she'd been with him in a tangle not so dissimilar during the Adran Kes War. Had the odds been better or worse? She couldn't quite remember.
"How hard will it be for the Dionys to get around us?"
"While we're on these foothill roads," Olam asked. "Fairly difficult."
"Good. Tell the engineers I want them to keep that wagon going as quickly as possible, no matter what the rest of the army does."
"You intend to stop and fight?" Olam asked with surprise.
"Stop is a poor word for what I plan. We're going to bloody their noses a little, and see what kind of sorcerer's support they have. Fetch me Taniel, Noreen, and Daft."
Flora listened to the screaming of horses as she lined up her next shot. Finding a proper line of sight in these foothills was next to impossible. It took climbing a tree on the next ridge over just to be able to witness the ambush the Rifle Jack Weir had arranged for the Dionys' vanguard. The ambush itself was in full swing. 600 of her riflemen firing staggered volleys into a column of dragoons. The column went back down the valley for as far as Flora could see, and had clearly not expected to run into the Riflejack so quickly. Once the firing had begun, they'd milled for almost a minute, the front line pushed ahead by the advancing column behind them, before charging up the hill toward her Riflejacks. The dragoons died by the score in that charge, but Flora forced herself to ignore them and kept her eyes on the column behind the battle. Her senses ablaze with a powder trance, she watched as word of the ambush was passed back beyond the curve of the next hill. She kept her gaze there, watching, waiting for the logical Dionys' response. It came within about 2 minutes. A Dionys, privileged, white gloves already on, appeared from down the column, his bodyguard shoving their way through the dragoons as he attempted to make his way forward to deal with the ambush. A privileged of reasonable power could do enough damage to her rearguard to allow his dragoons to advance.
If he had a lot of power, he might be able to brush them aside single-handedly.
Flora had no interest in finding out. She braced the barrel of her rifle on the branch in front of her as she focused on the privileged. She opened her